stars.
Thank you. And I've been asked to talk about oscillations in red giant stars in only an hour and 20 minutes, and so I'll have to talk very fast. Let us go back to some history, because I wouldn't want people to think that the world began with Corot and Kepler. For you young people in the room, there was life before that. So the first question is, question for the audience, when was the first detection of an oscillation in a red giant star? Quick? Got to be quick? It was in 1596, of course. And it was, of course, Myra, the wonderful. And so just to show you that Kepler can also observe Myras, isn't that a very pretty light curve? But of course, Myras are excited by a heat engine mechanism, and we are interested in stars that are much more solar-like. So while Myra itself would be about here somewhere, what I'm going to talk about today are the stars below that, the G and K type giants, which are, people had hoped, excited in a similar way to the Sun, and therefore would show a spectrum similar to the Sun. So the goal that people had was to find, dead or alive, a big red giant version of the solar spectrum. So, to go back to a little bit of history to do this quickly, if I zoom in on this part of the diagram here, very conveniently, Arcturus and Pollux are labeled here, two very bright K giants, and one of the first evidences for oscillations in red giants came back in the late 1980s, and Arcturus is the black dots, and you can see that it is wobbling about with a period of a few days in radial velocity. And there were many attempts after this, and the first photometric detection came from space, also in K giants in 47 Tuck, Peter Edmonds and Ron Gilliland, and again, oscillations with periods of a couple of days in K giants. Interestingly, the very last sentence of this abstract says, an understanding of their variations may have significant ramifications for theories of stellar structure and stellar evolution. And I think you'll agree, at least by the end of my talk, I hope you'll agree that that was completely correct and very prescient. Anyway, let's skip ahead to, what year was this? I haven't written the year up there. 2002-ish? Oh, yeah, it's up there, sorry, 2002. The star Xi Hydra, southern G giant star, observed with the Swiss Corelli telescope, and you can see there are pulsations here. But if you look at the power spectrum from a month's worth of data, it's kind of messy, and it's hard to see if there is a regular series of peaks here. Most of what you see is dominated by the side lobes from the fact that it's a single site set of observations. And there's a bit of a worry here, because it's more messy than you would have thought. And so this got people very worried. And the thing they were worried about was mode lifetimes. If you observe the modes in the Sun for a very long period, every single mode is spread out into this beautiful Lorentzian-type envelope. And the width of that envelope is a couple of microhertz, which tells you the lifetime of the modes is a couple of days. Now, that doesn't matter in the Sun, because the periods are 5 minutes. So this is a very high Q oscillation. You know, a Q of an oscillator, frequency over delta frequency. But if red giants had similar lifetimes, but they have periods of hours or days, then we're in trouble, because all of the modes would be blurred out and would run into each other. And so that was a real concern. And it seemed to be in Xi Hydra, we couldn't measure the lifetimes directly, but simulations seemed to show that the lifetimes were indeed only a couple of days. And so there was this paper with the rather depressing title, Will Strong Mode Damping Limit Astroseismology in Red Giant Stars? Fortunately, you can always rely on the theoreticians to come to the rescue. And Gunter and Douglas argued that the mode lifetimes in these stars should be much longer, several weeks. Were they right? Well, a little bit more history very quickly so we don't forget our old friends. Wire was a telescope that failed beautifully, and the star tracker on it was used very cleverly by Derek Bujashi, and one of the highlights of it was finding oscillations in red giants. Arcturus itself, a photometric variable with a period indeed of a couple of days, and some other red giants which seemed to show power excesses. But again, we still haven't really seen that regular P-mode structure that we're looking for. We're still wanting to find this thing. And some more observations from the ground with two telescopes, Corelli and LED, these beautifully named spectrographs. A heroic effort, and it did seem to find a regular series of peaks, especially if you colour them in very pretty colours. But it really wasn't until space that it started to go really well. And of course, the first in space was MOST, not Jamie Matthews himself, but his satellite. And that satellite observed the same star that I just showed you, Epsilon Ophiuchi from space. And finally, we can see a power excess with a clear regular series of peaks and no worries about the window function. So that's good news. We can measure nu max, the frequency of maximum power, and we can measure delta nu. The problem again is how wide are the modes? And it seems again that the modes are pretty wide. It looks like they're a couple of microhertz wide. And so they conclude the line widths and the fits indicate a short lifetime of only a few days. Now in the sun, a few days is fine, but in red giants with periods of hours, as this one has, that's a disaster. You can't do astroseismology very well with such broad peaks. So it was a little depressing, but this question seemed to be answered in the negative. Well, in the positive, with a yes. So along, of course, then came our friend Corot, which was launched now 2006, was it really so long ago? And this wonderful, wonderful result, absolutely clear, unambiguous detection of the P-mode oscillations in dozens and dozens of red giants, in fact, even hundreds. And so finally, we could say that, yes, we have found what we were looking for, red giants in space oscillating from space and in space. Okay, so, of course, Corot then proceeded to observe many of these things. This is a modified Hertzsprung-Russell diagram. Instead of plotting luminosity, we plot nu max, which is a fairly good indicator for luminosity if you plot it backwards. So the sun is down here with a nu max of 3,000 microhertz. And this is the situation before the launch of Corot. The handful of ground-based observations of main sequence stars, many of which Travis just talked about, and a couple of those red giants which I mentioned from the ground. And with the launch of Corot, we were able to populate a couple more down here, but up here a lot. So look at all those beautiful red giants oscillating with frequencies of around about 30 microhertz, which is periods of hours. That clump you see is in fact the red clump. So just to remind you, stars evolve up the main, off the main sequence, up the red giant branch, and they get to the very top, which I can't reach, and they ignite helium, and then they fall back down again, and they settle onto this clump, which is the helium-burning main sequence. Some people call it the horizontal branch, some people call it the red clump. And this will occur a lot. So that was a wonderful result, hundreds of stars, and what you may well call the birth of ensemble astroseismology. And I don't have time to go into all of the work that was done in these papers. Fortunately, some of these people are here, and certainly I hope that Andrea will talk about some of this work when he talks in a couple of days' time. But I must move on because Kepler went up. And of course, Kepler changed our lives very much for the better, although we're all a little busier than we used to be, I suspect. And even after the first month, it was clear with Kepler how wonderful the data were going to be. And we could see beautiful power spectra of a range of stars. And because Kepler is well away from the Earth and not worrying about going around the Earth and the Earth's shine, it could observe stars with much higher frequencies than Corot could do. And so it was able to populate this diagram. So this is the situation before Kepler, and there we go. It's worth pausing to look at this beautiful figure made by Daniel Huber. It's really just extraordinary. The color coding is amplitude. I'll talk a little bit about amplitudes, but not much today. But you can see that we now populate the entire region up to the very top, and the reason we stop at the top is not that there are no stars oscillating, the periods become too long. And you know, obviously you need longer and longer periods to observe more stars. Kepler's been observing now for around about 2 years and still going strong. So that was my kind of very fast introduction through the field. What I'll do now in my remaining hour and 10 minutes is to tell you some of the scientific results. And there'll be more, I hope, that we'll talk about over the next few days. In particular, Marc-Antoine and Andrea are going to talk. One of the things you can do is model individual stars, very much like Travis has just talked about. And I'm not going to talk about that. There's not been much done on that. Really, only three of the Corot and Kepler stars have been done in that way. And you can read these papers if you're interested. But I'm going to move on quickly and talk much more about ensemble seismology. Now, Travis already mentioned the main parameters we can measure, the large spacing, delta nu, and the peak of the envelope, nu max. And the first thing you can do is put one against the other. And Dennis Stello noticed that there was a nice correlation between them. If you take just the published results and plot one versus the other, you see they fall in a log-log plot on a pretty good straight line. Definitely good by astronomy standards. The red giants are sitting down the bottom here, and these are the main sequence stars up there. Meanwhile, the Corot results were coming in, and if you home in just on the red giants at the bottom, Saskia Hecker found a similar plot. This is not a log plot, That's why it's not a straight line, but it would be if you did take the logarithms. And you can ask yourself why there's such a straight line, and it's actually very easy to understand. But anyway, let's quickly first show the Kepler results, which now extend from the main sequence up here, and the Sun would be up here somewhere, all the way down through the subgiants and the red giants. This change in colour, by the way, is Kepler has two observing modes. You can either observe once a minute or once every half hour. And the half hour is plenty for the red giants, and these are the up here. So isn't that lovely? So stars evolve down this way. They get to the tip of the red giant branch, and then they come back to the red clump like this. Very, very pretty diagram. We can understand it fairly simply from the scaling relations Travis already mentioned. The large spacing is square root density, and nu max is proportional to the acoustic cutoff frequency, which Tim Brown and collaborators long ago suggested should scale in this way. And so both of these things scale more or less as m over r to the 2 and a bit, m over r to the 2 and a bit. So they scale in a very similar way, and when you plot one against the other, that's why you get that tight correlation. But it's not a perfect correlation, and if you take this line and divide by it to remove this overall trend, you'll see scatter about it. And that scatter, of course, encodes information about the mass and radius and temperature of the star. And so when you divide by that line, you get this diagram, and this indeed, this scatter is mostly dominated by changes in mass. So you can use this to measure masses. And this is exactly what Travis just said. So I've got a slide that's almost identical to his. I'm glad that Hans was late, because Travis has given a very quick introduction to a lot of the stuff that I was going to say. So you solve those two equations for the two unknowns, and you get mass and radius. And of course, if you know mass and radius, you also know luminosity. Important point, which very important, is we need temperatures. That's why it's so important to have effective temperatures, and that's why Mark is here to tell us all the wonderful temperatures that he's been figuring out for these stars. Effective temperatures are very valuable. So what this means is that we can get masses and radii for all of these red giants, and you can plot them on an HR diagram. Here's one of several examples. This is the red clump color-coded with mass here, and so most of them are one solar mass, and then up here you have the slightly heavier stars, which are the secondary clump stars, which did not go through a helium flash. Okay, so we can get mass, radius, and luminosity for all of our stars, provided we believe those scaling relations, and they're pretty accurate to a few percent, and also provided we have good effective temperatures. But there's lots more we can do, and so in my remaining hour and 5 minutes, I will tell you some of them. We mustn't forget the clusters. A lot of astronomy is based on open clusters, historically stellar astronomy. There are a few in the field, and two quite good ones. They're not particularly bright, but we're able to reach in oscillations certainly down most of the red giant branch, including the clump and almost to the base of the red giant branch in these two clusters here. The upper cluster, by the way, is somewhat metal-rich. Is that the right one, Simone? Yeah. So one thing you can do is just check for membership. So all you do is measure the large spacings of the stars, plot it here, plot large spacing against the V magnitude, and the clusters, in fact, three clusters are shown here, follow trends, and the outliers are so obvious anyone could see them. And so it's obvious which ones are not cluster members. That's a fairly straightforward application. Much more interesting, of course, is to get the ages. And this is a paper that Savani worked on, so you should ask her all the questions. These ages now were gotten by using the large spacing and nu max together with a grid of models. It was not using the small spacings or any detailed modeling. So these are kind of the rough ensemble ages. But you can see that there's some scatter about a mean value, which agrees pretty well with what was thought for these stars. One is much younger than the other, as you can see, for these two clusters. It would be wonderful if these clusters were nearer and brighter, and by the end of the mission we probably can push our detection threshold down here, but I don't know how far it will go down. Obviously it would be wonderful to get main sequence stars in this cluster, but I think it's probably unlikely. Shame that Plato wasn't selected. A quick mention of this, but maybe Andreas will talk about this later. This is the metal-rich cluster. And if you divide the stars into the stars on the RGB, which of course are the hydrogen-burning stars, and the stars that are settled on the main the red clump burning helium, and you look at the difference in masses, and that tells you whether there was mass loss when they went up to the tip. You expect mass loss, and in fact for a metal-rich cluster you expect quite a lot of mass loss. What they found was a little bit. And so, unfortunately, the colour coding is different for the two plots, but the red diamonds on the left are the RGB stars, here shown in blue, And the green on the right are the clump stars. And you can see that there's a slight offset of the green points are slightly lower on average than the red points. But they're not much lower, and these are three different models for three different values of the mass loss parameter, and you can see that the mass loss discrepancy is not as big as you would expect from certainly high mass. Anyway, Andreas should talk about that. I'm not going to talk about amplitudes because I don't have time, so I'll skip over that and get into what I think is the most exciting thing, look more closely at the frequency spectra. So these are quite some pretty plots which are just there to look pretty when you stack up the power spectra. But let me just skip a couple of slides now because Travis already talked about the CD diagram and how it's not useful for red giants and show you this. So this is one of the early Kepler red giants after 1 month. And what you see is something interesting. You see the 0 and 2 modes and then 1, 0, 2 and 1. But the 1s come in little clusters. See that? Those little clusters there are very interesting. Keep an eye on them as time goes by, or not time squared, after 10 months and then after 19 months. This is the same red giant. And those little clusters are now beautifully resolved into very, very narrow peaks. Our worries about mode lifetime, by the way, are gone. Right? If I zoom in here, you can see that the line widths of the L equals zero mode is much, much, much less than microhertz. So there's no problem with mode lifetimes in these stars. You can see now why we were confused early on. It's all of this mess. These L equals one modes, why are there so many of them? There should only be one L equals one mode. Well, the answer is they're mixed modes. So we don't have time to go into all the theory of mixed modes, but they arrive from coupling between the core and the envelope. You have a P mode in the envelope, which couples with a G mode in the core and gives you a mixed mode. Now, the G modes in the core in these stars are very dense in the frequency space. There are lots and lots and lots of them. So there are lots of mixed modes. And some of those mixed modes are observable. And that's been one of the wonderful discoveries. And it was predicted theoretically, or at least explained at the same time theoretically. And there's this very nice paper by Marc-Antoine and colleagues. And so what you're seeing here is a theoretical spectrum of a red giant. L equals zero modes are the crosses at the top, and they're nicely behaved. And the L equals two modes, which are the dots here, are also quite nicely behaved. But the L equals one modes, you see, you get this cluster every time. And these modes here are all the mixed modes. And those little clusters look exactly like the little clusters that we observe. But the interesting thing is that those little clusters are spaced according to G modes. And as you probably know, I hope you know, G modes are regularly spaced not in frequency but in period. And so the period spacing of these little guys in here is giving us a handle on the G mode spacing of the core. And that's what we were able to detect. So the first result was published in just one of those stars by Paul Beck. And each of these little clusters here has a period spacing which matches the models. And then what we discovered is you could divide the stars into two. These stars are very similar. They have more or less the same large spacing. But if you look closely at the little multiplets here, the L equals 1 multiplets clusters in this star are more widely spaced than the ones in this. You see that? And so there's a difference. If you measure the spacings of the two, the stars fall neatly into two groups. And those two groups are plotted here. Now this is a very pretty figure. It's got large spacing along the bottom. That's the P-mode spacing between the clusters. And on this axis, it has the period spacing of the little individual clusters. And of course, period spacings are measured in seconds. And so all of the blue points here are the stars with a smaller period spacing. And it turns out these are all the hydrogen shell-burning stars on the red giant branch. And the stars with a larger period spacing are the stars burning helium on the clump. And even those stars you can divide into two. The red ones are the ones of lower mass that had a flash, and the orange ones are the ones on the secondary clump that did not go through a flash. So it's very pretty, it all works out nicely, and it allows us to use these modes to probe the cores of these stars. The reason they have a different period spacing, Jörn explained, it's not because they're burning helium, oscillations don't care what's burning, it's because they have a convective core, these stars. And the convective core confines the G modes to a shell, because they can't be in the core and they can't be in the envelope. And so that's why their period spacing changes. So a very nice result. A star evolves across this way, up the red giant branch, so it's going upwards to the top, and then it ignites helium and comes back along here, but rather than landing back on top of itself as it does in a normal diagram, it nicely separates. And so you can distinguish the two populations. Similar results have been found, I should point out, for Corot by Benoit Mosset and colleagues. Okay, the final thing, and this I must point out is a Nature paper that is in press at the moment, so it's under embargo, so if there are any journalists in the room, please don't go out and tell the world. But it should be coming out very soon, I think in the next couple of weeks, with a puzzle. Because these two papers give us a major dilemma, which I hope that somebody in the audience, probably Douglas Goff, can solve for us. This is only, I should say, a proof. It hasn't yet appeared, and it may change. Does one put a hyphen in red giant stars or not? I'll leave you with a question. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
These are so wonderful. Yes, the last.
As time goes by and you get the period spacing better, do you feel as if you're going to be able to really get delta P for the G modes as opposed to the observed? There's an ambiguity, as you well know, between what the observers measure and the G mode spacing that one would actually calculate theoretically, sort of the asymptotic limit. And there's some ambiguity in the literature about that. So
yes. It'd
be interesting to hear your views now that you have more data.
Yeah, we already are. In fact, there's a paper in preparation. Benoit Mosset is the first author, which is doing more on this, and it shows you that you can indeed recover the true G-mode spacing. Essentially what you have to do, I don't know if I have a plot of this, let me quickly zoom ahead. No, I hit it. Let's see if I can find it. You make a shell diagram in period space. No, that one.
Nope.
No, it's not that one. Okay, I don't have it. I'm sorry. We'll get back to that in discussions. So you can make in a shell diagram in period space, and you can actually trace the true G-mode spacing. And yes, I'm sure we'll be able to do that for a lot of these stars.
No questions, comments? Yeah, please. I have a microphone. I just want to point out that the period spacing that you're finding in the helium core stars looks exactly like the period spacing we see in sub-dwarf B stars that are pulsating, that show mode trapping and all sorts of goodies.
It does, yes.
So it's as if in the SDB stars you just throw away the envelope, but the oscillations haven't changed at all.
Yeah, in fact, Simon O'Toole pointed that out to me. And somebody who was on the paper should have said that, but they didn't, did they?
Well, we all thought it was so obvious. That was no need to say it.
Yeah, an SDB star is a naked red giant, indeed.
Well, you only have like 50 words in Nature anyway, so. More questions, comments? Come on.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask a quick question. So the difference between the gold and the red, that's from other information, not from the pulsation.
Yeah, right? I skipped over that. It is from the pulsation still. It's using the scaling relations, the Newmax delta nu scale relations, which give you a handle on the mass. And you can separate those stars in that diagram. I didn't show this plot, but this is a slightly newer plot which shows at least one model. Jern's models are stupid and can't do helium flashes. But they can do higher mass stars. And so this higher mass 2.4 solar mass star goes to the tip and back again, and then beautifully lines up. These blue points are equally spaced in time, and so it exactly matches the secondary clump here of where it should be.
Too good.
Of course, there are other models that can go through helium flashes.
So again, now that you have more data, can you say more about the lifetimes for either the clump or the red giants at around 5 microhertz, or are they still unresolved? No evidence.
Oh, the line widths.
Line widths.
Well, the radial modes are certainly resolved. Do you mean the non-radial modes, the L equals 1 modes? I haven't looked carefully, so I should check, but I think there are...
And get to masses of about 0.6, of course you're getting wheeled on the horizontal branch, so hot enough that you're not... expect to detect solar light pulsation, but more RR Lyrae star type. So that's a selection somehow. So you're not getting the whole distribution of masses in the, well, not, it's not called the right clump anymore. It's more a horizontal branch star, but yeah, that's a bias that you introduce.
Thank you. Any more questions, comments?
You didn't ask my question about the hyphen. We need to tell Nature. Surely you wouldn't put a hyphen, would you, Douglas, in red giant star? You would. Well,
surely you would.
You would.
I would.
Goodness.
I think I told you to, actually, but...
I don't think you told me to, did you?
Pardon?
Just for fun. I mean, doesn't that depend on what is before? I mean, the second time it was helium burning was before. Helium burning radiant stars. The first time it was just radiant stars. Once you told me that the slab something before or not.
This is an excellent thing to talk about over coffee. Who's here, man? To finish on the point about the lifetimes, the fact that we are not resolving these modes still shows that we need to observe them longer. And the fact that we need to observe them longer shows that we need to keep Kepler operating for longer. And I should remind you that if we don't do anything drastic and convince NASA, Kepler is going to stop observing in a year from now. It still has fuel and everything left for another 5 years. So you those of you who can should talk to your congressman and convince him, her, that we need this mission for as long as possible. Because it really could be shut down despite the fact that it's working perfectly. So thank you, Tim. Justin, do you have any organizational issues? Coffee.